The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin period, Paris' defenses, 1380. Now, of course, John de Montfort's hand in Brittany was strengthened by the developing financial crisis of the French government. On November the 14th, 1380, the Estates General of Languedoc met for the first time since 1369 in the palace on the Ile de la Cité. The four royal dukes presided impassively as the chancellor, Mille de Durance, outlined the government's dire financial situation. The proceedings of the assembly are poorly documented, and its decisions are difficult to reconstruct from the terse formula of the closing ordinances and the misleading gossip of the chroniclers. But some common themes emerged from all the national and provincial assemblies which would meet during the first year of the new reign to grapple with the problems of war finance. It was generally accepted that financial assistance to the crown in time of war was an obligation of every subject. The complaints were not so much about the principle of war taxation as about the way in which Charles V transformed the grants of 1360s into permanent taxes. The assemblies were determined to reestablish the principle that taxation was not a prerogative of the crown. It was a grant from its subjects, made for a limited period and subject to review and the redress of their grievances. The real division was between the majority, which accepted that the current crisis justified a grant of taxation, and a small but powerful minority who considered that its present state, France, could bear no extraordinary taxation at all. They thought, like the parliamentary opposition in England, that the king should be compelled to live off the ordinary revenues of his demesnes. The leaders of this group were the city of Paris, which traditionally dominated deliberations of the Third Estate. They were supported by a powerful caucus of nobility. However, before the Estates General could reach a conclusion, the issue was taken out of their hands by a Paris mob. What else is new? Now, in spite of war and plague, Paris was as populous at the end of the 14th century as it had been at the first outbreak of the Black Death. The new rampart of Charles V was roughly double the area of the city on the right bank of the Seine, enclosing ancient suburbs, allotments, vineyards, and provoking a prolonged building boom. Apart from the cemeteries, the gardens of the monasteries and the aristocratic mansion, and the drained marshland, still known as the Marais, almost every available space within the walls was built over by 1380. Houses rose 2, 3, and sometimes as many as 6 stories above tiny plots of land, separated by dark and filthy lanes. Some 200,000 people lived in this place, one of the densest concentrations of humanity in Europe. Even in more ordered times, Paris had always been an immensely political place. Its main business was government, and as it always has been. Its economy was sustained directly or indirectly by the service of the king, the great noblemen and ecclesiastical princes who attended on him, and the judges, lawyers, administrators, courtiers who waxed rich in the business of the crown. The king, the dukes of Anjou, Berry, Burgundy, Bourbon, Brittany, and the counts of Alençon, Artois, Armagnac, Flanders, Hainault, and Auvergne, and a dozen other noblemen and nearly 30 bishops and abbots maintained their own palaces in the capital, some of them built and staffed on a grand scale. These men were the actors on a national stage. They were visible symbols of power, targets for social grievances and political complaint. More than 100 bell towers tolled the great occasions of the political and ecclesiastical calendar. Rumors and grievances magnified amongst the tightly packed residents of the alley tenements. Crowds quickly gathered in the few open spaces within the walls. The fortune of war heightened public emotion, threatening the security of the city and interrupting the distant network of suppliers which fed its immense population. Sharp contrasts of wealth and poverty were always too obvious where slums grew up beside palaces, nobles pushing through crowds on horseback escorted by liveried outriders, and the fortunate of whatever origin exhibited their property with colored silks and jewelry and extravagant hats and shoes. In the 1380s, a rising tide of migration into the city combined with economic contraction to produce high levels of unemployment among the mass of insecure journeymen and laborers, and mounting class hostility among the poor and the young. Hard times made yesterday's workers into today's mobsters, carrion of tomorrow's gallows. Charles V had passed more time in his capital than any of his predecessors. The tumults of the 1350s taught him the power of the mob. He had devoted much attention to the security of the city. The main agent of royal control in Paris was the provost. The office was held from 1367 to 1381 by the formidable and authoritarian Hugh Aubert, a self-made man of modest origins whose father had been a Dijon money changer. He made a bigger difference to the appearance of the city than any one man before, Baron Haussmann. And like Haussmann, most of his acts were directed in one way or another to holding down the city of revolutions. He was responsible for a raft of ordinances and decrees regulating disorderly conduct, idleness, prostitution, taverns, and gaming houses, and the bearing of arms in the streets. A reformed police force consisting of 220 sergeants served in shifts, based at the Châtelet. Their efforts were supplemented by the sergeants employed by various abbeys exercising criminal jurisdiction in the city, and at night by the watch, a militia drawn from the richer householders and organized by the city guilds in units of 10 and 50. But even in Aubert's time, the government had no way of confronting a serious outbreak of urban violence without raising an army to overawe the city from the outside. By the time of Charles V's death, the city's defenses, which Aubert largely rebuilt, were directed as much against the inhabitants as its external enemy. The Louvre lay well within the new rampart, but survived, rebuilt, and enlarged as a garrisoned refuge, prison, treasury, and arsenal. The towers of the Châtelet looked down on the butchers' quarters, famous for generations of Parisians as the home of the most violent mobs. Opposite, on the left bank, Aubert had constructed a small urban fortress, the Petit Châtelet, to allow the authorities to seal off the riotous students of the university quarter on the left bank from the rest of the city. At the eastern edge of the city, the intimidating mass of the Bastille de Saint-Antoine, whose foundation stone had been laid in 1370 by Aubert himself, was rising from its foundations. Then, on the morning of November the 15th, 1380, a large crowd gathered in the Place de Grève to protest against the burden of war taxation. Now we have a little uprising again. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.